Transform your life today. Welcome to Supercoach with Michael Neal.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you may be. Our topic for today is delayed gratification made fun. And the numbers to call for coaching on any area of your life are 866-254-1579. It's toll free, 866-254-1579. Or from outside the United States, you can reach the show on 001-760-918-4300. Just going to set the table today. Sharing a story. Some of you may have come across the marshmallow experiment, and it's one of the more famous experiments in modern psychology, and it was designed by a researcher named Walter Mischel, and he wanted to explore the validity of self-control and delayed gratification as a predictor of future success, because for years, people have said, you know, you need to be willing to wait, and you need to be willing to delay your gratification, and that will lead to more success, and he wanted to just see how it really worked. So here's the experiment that he designed. Got a group of four-year-old children in, one at a time, and they were given a marshmallow. And they were told that they could have a second one if they would wait until the experimenter came back into the room. So the researchers monitored the progress of the children. The children weren't told how long they were going to have to wait. They were just told if they waited, they would get a second marshmallow. And over years, following these kids from 4 years old to adolescence to adulthood, here were some of the things. The children who waited for the second marshmallow, who they called delayers, scored an average of 210 points higher on their SATs. 210 points higher by waiting for a second marshmallow. And as they grew older, they reported having more fulfilling relationships, higher self-esteem, more success in their careers. Now, the conclusion that Michelle and the researchers drew from this was that there actually is a direct link between our ability to delay gratification, to put off the reward now, and our ability to have greater success and greater happiness in life. And, you know, if you look at the economy, okay, we can kind of see the second marshmallow principle there, that, you know, many, many financial institutions have been brought to their knees by marshmallow grabbers in their own ranks, offering a decade's worth of loans to marshmallow grabbing businessmen and homeowners, and now it's all kind of falling apart. So here's for me the key to this and to really making use of delaying gratification as a fun thing, as something you can play with in your own life, is if our ability to wait for the second marshmallow and delay our gratification is going to be a key to success, how do we increase our self-control? How do we increase our self-mastery? And how do we ensure that our children and our employees and the people that we work with develop those traits? So I'm going to talk more about that, but for now, let's go to the phones. Let's go to Stefan in New Jersey. Is it Stefan or Stephen?
Stefan.
Stefan. I didn't even think of that. Darn it. All right, Stefan, what can I do for you today?
Well, Michael, about 3 months ago, I was laid off of my job of 20 years in journalism and at a very big newspaper, and I am now looking to translate my skills into a new industry. It's probably going to be web-based the way things are going. Mm-hmm. And I'm currently in the process of dealing with someone who's looking to most likely hire me. However, his new startup company that he's starting, he's been very successful in the travel hotel business on the web, is something that might not start up till the end of the year, and my severance that I have may not last that long. And I'm trying to feel this process out without moving too hard with him, because I don't want to. He's trying to educate me right now about his business. He's trying to also see how translatable my skills are, which he already thinks they are. Mm-hmm. But he hasn't offered me a salary yet, nor have we really talked money, and we're about to very soon this week. And I was just curious as to how one would feel out this type of process, because I know that I have a 20-year, as they would say, master's degree in journalism. But the thing, and all the experience I have in context, but the thing is that it is a new industry, and I have to, you know, I'm trying to feel this out and see how to. I've never dealt with translating my skills or dealing with an employer out of the corporate environment such as what I was in for 20 okay. years. It's a whole new game for me.
A whole new ball game.
Yeah.
But fortunately, it's a whole new ball game that still has human beings in it.
Right.
So there are going to be certain things that are predictable.
Right. right. Oh, and can I just add one thing?
I have to do the whole thing on one leg blindfolded. No, okay. What's yours?
Well, I got to know this gentleman through the fact that we had our kids at the same time. We became socially engaged, and now, you know, now he's looking to possibly give me a job. So that's the other element in all of this.
Right, and that feels like a relevant factor because I'm not saying it isn't, but...
Well, just because I've never networked with anybody before who I've known and then ended up working for them. Let's put it that way. I worked for this giant corporation for 20 years, so now it's a whole different...
So let's just talk. Let me speak to it, and we'll see which of those things might be relevant and which of them are just facts.
Okay.
Because some of that's just true.
Okay.
But it might not really interfere with your ability to get what you want.
Okay.
In any situation to do with employment, if you go in as the one in need, you're going to be somewhat at the mercy of the one with the money. In other words, that's the way it is for a lot of people. Is they go, well, they've got a scarce resource, which is money, and I've got this, you know, not so scarce resources, which is my skill, my talent, whatever. So I need to really hope that they want me and do whatever they say so that they'll want me.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there may be an element. It doesn't sound to me like your skills are particularly massively replicable, that there is a limit of, you know, not that there's nobody else on the planet that could do it, but that actually, you know, you're one of the few people who are in a position to really bring those skills into this industry. Is that a fair description, or is it, you know, could I just walk in and do it tomorrow?
Oh, no. I think that, you know, I have the skills that he definitely needs. And I think that they're definitely, you know, yeah, I think I'm in a very solid position. Let's put it that way.
So this is a mutually beneficial thing. If you go in, he's not doing you a favor and you're not doing him a favor.
Yeah, pretty much so. No, I don't. I shouldn't feel that way. And no, I don't. No, I don't.
Okay, great. So that's good to know going in. So it stops you from doing a silly deal.
Right, right.
You know, because it's not like, it's like, hang on, this isn't a favor. I don't have to just take what I'm offered. This is something that if it works is great, and if it doesn't work is great. So I've got two ideas that I want to give you.
Okay.
One is, my friend Steve Chandler calls this the Steve Young principle. Okay. I don't know how much football you used to follow.
Steve Young well. I thought he was a great quarterback.
Okay. So here was the thing. When the 49ers had Joe Montana and Steve Young,
okay,
they were really unstoppable because if you knock Joe Montana out of the game,
right,
you had to face Steve Young.
Right.
So there is definitely something very powerful in creating a backup plan that is as good or even better than going to work for this guy.
Okay.
Because to the extent that you can do that, then you can be really clean in your negotiations with him.
Okay.
If this is it, if your backup plan is poverty, you're going to probably start to kind of sell yourself a bit short. So, you know, in other words, if you know, well, okay, I could have Joe Montana, but if Joe Montana falls through, I've got Steve Young, you're going to absolutely still want to do Joe Montana, but it's not going to be that big a deal if it doesn't. So you're not going to put yourself, you're not going to overextend yourself. I don't know if you've, you know, negotiation, it's not about trying to screw the other guy, but it's also not about screwing yourself.
Well, exactly. See, I think the thing that maybe now that you say that about Steve Young and Joe Montana, the comparison and the analogy and everything, I think that what maybe is in the back of my head is when I started off talking to this gentleman, it was pretty much on the basis that, well, nothing's happening now. A month has gone by, 2 months gone by, still nothing's happened. And, yeah, I'm really interested in this now that you present it to me. And I kind of feel that maybe I sold myself a little short at first. And he gave me some even tips for my resume at first, and now he's going to possibly be. So I'm hoping I didn't sell myself short at first, and now I'm hoping that I see what I really do have after exploring this fully. And now I'm looking to regain momentum here without, you know, feeling that I took too many steps back with him at first in our conversation.
Yeah, and to an extent, it doesn't matter whether or not you did, because you don't have to show up that way now.
Okay, okay.
You know, even if it's like, well, I thought you really wanted this. And, you know, well, I do. And, you know, this is what I've come to realize. So that, in a way, one of the best preps you can do before you go into the negotiation is really develop that backup plan.
Okay. Okay.
Because that just puts you in a place where when you're there, you're going to be as comfortable as you can be, because it's like, well, you know what? I really want to make this work. And if we can't make it work, it's not like I'm on the street.
No, no, exactly. I mean, this actual meeting is actually going to take place in a couple of days and over brunch. And the thing is that I know that, you know, I still have about a year to stay afloat, thank God, which is a gift right now.
Sure.
And I want to, and I know that I'm going to use that. And I'm really trying to set myself up exactly in that frame of mind. So what you're telling me is reassuring that I should go in there with a position of strength. And basically know that, okay, if this doesn't work out, then okay, you hit the pavement again, and you keep going.
Right, exactly. And that doesn't mean that you go in with an arrogance, with a
no.
I don't need you, buddy. It just means you go in knowing, hey, if this works, fantastic. If it doesn't work, fantastic. I love you. You've been a great friend. You're still a great friend. Huzzah!
Right.
So that's one thing. Let me just give you one other thought with,
mm-hmm.
and the other thought is to do with setting yourself up as self-employed even as you go back into employment. Now, there's a couple of different ways to do that. I'm gonna share with you my favorite. And what it is you set up, and this is, you don't have to follow this system exactly, but this system has worked for certainly the thousands of people I've shared it with, is you set up a reservoir account, which is just a savings account,
mm-hmm.
and a checking account. And the reservoir account is all money comes into that account, whatever source it comes from, that's the account it comes into. It's a reservoir. It collects money. And then each month, you pay yourself a salary. So you decide, okay, this is the salary I want. I want to, you know, I want to have $6,000 a month to live on. You know, whatever it is. You pay yourself that salary from your reservoir. So when you do a deal, if you do it with this guy or if you do it with someone else, that's not your employer. That's just a funding source for your reservoir. And when you start to do it that way, your relationship with your employer changes from one that can often be almost a resentment that starts to form because you feel like, oh, I better be nice to him because he's the one who pays the bills.
Right.
You know, and all that, to a relationship between equals.
Right.
Because you're actually your own boss.
Right.
He's just one of your funding sources for your reservoir.
Right.
And funnily enough, because you're doing it that way, you can actually usually create a much stronger relationship. Because let's face it, you're always going to have a stronger relationship when you have two equals in the room, when you have one up, one down.
Mm-hmm.
And what a lot of people do is they try and make themselves one up.
Mm-hmm.
And that doesn't work any better than making yourself one down. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no. Yeah, I definitely. I mean, most of it clicks. Most of
All
it
right.
clicks.
Fantastic.
Any
other questions on it?
Well, the only other thing is that in moving into this position as well, I mean, he opened the door towards possibly saying, well, let's see if we can meet and keep you afloat till I start this new company up at the end of the year. So what I'm going to do is I'm pretty much of the frame of mind, having talked to a couple of people I know who are very business savvy, that I'm going to go in there and pretty much, you know, try to get some sort of firm commitment with an sort of an intent to hire.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a smart strategy?
It's a smart strategy if it's real.
Right.
In other words, you know, a firm commitment with intent to hire is either some nice sounding words or it's actually a firm commitment with intent to hire.
Right. No, I see. What I'm trying to say is I've shown him commitment. I mean, basically I'm doing all this reading. I'm doing all this, he's sending me tons of stuff to read and learn and this and that. And I'm committing a lot of time to this and trying to manage my time. And also at the same time, look for a job.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if this doesn't work out, like you said. But I'm definitely going to now, you know, make sure I go in there with a position of strength, no matter what I feel I've said in the past 3 months.
Yeah, because that's just that's what you said. That was then. This is now.
Right, exactly. Okay.
That's not an issue. So yeah, it sounds like you're well prepared, and think about, really do take a little bit of time to think about, well, okay, what would work great for me? You know what? All right, what would work great for me is if I could get a sort of a retainer of this much a month, which will just go into my reservoir and just help out in the short term. And in exchange for that retainer, I'm going to continue to develop my ideas and develop and do the studying and do the preparation, with the idea that this job will start properly whenever it does at this salary that we've pre-negotiated.
Right.
And then if at that point it doesn't materialize, then I get to make a different decision about where I go from there.
Right, right. No, exactly. Because one thing I do know after ending a 20-year career is that those days are pretty much gone. So you pretty much have to know how to, you know, prepare yourself for the next step, because they're, you know, most likely is not going to be those 20-year careers around anymore.
and that's the beauty of switching the focus from employee to creator, from employee to self-employed.
Right.
Where it's like, hey, all I'm doing is looking for ways to use my skills to fund my reservoir, because I'm my own boss.
I see what you're saying. Yeah, because if you put yourself in a good position and keep doing so financially and everything else, and making sure you're putting some stuff away, then you don't have to sweat the details as much later on, right?
Exactly. And I'll tell you, it's a bizarre thing, but I've had so many letters from people. I put this strategy in my first book, You Can Have What You Want, and I've had so many letters from people going, well, I don't know how it happened, but my reservoir suddenly has $10,000 in it. My reservoir suddenly... There's something psychological about the fact that you're taking money away from yourself to spend instead of trying to take money away from yourself to save.
Right.
That just means that the reservoir grows quicker.
Yeah. No, my wife always preaches that. Absolutely. Yeah.
I shall join her in the pulpit.
Okay, great. Sure.
All right, Stefan, thank you so much for phoning.
Thank you.
All right.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Okay, and if you want to phone in for coaching, the numbers to call are 866-254-1579. It's toll-free, 866-254-1579, or from outside the United States, 001-760-918-4300. It's such an interesting thing, but so many of us have been conditioned to approach life, to come into life as the beggars at the table. Even in... Hollywood, the writer Ben Stein, when he was quite successful here, he had a show, Win Ben Stein's Money, and he was is still a fantastic writer. He actually writes some books at Hay House. He had a thing where he talked about when they were going around, they were beggars in Porsches. So even though they were driving these really nice cars and had all this money, they were still coming at it like, well, they've got the money and all we've got is this little humble skill. And that's just not a way to make things work, because the truth of it is that you are you, and the more of you bring to what you do, the more of a unique resource you become. In other words, there's only one of you, so you're the ultimate scarce resource. But if all you present is, well, I'm just my skill, and it's a skill lots of people have, or I'm just going to do this the way everyone else does it because I want to fit in, you become less and less of a scarce resource. And when you become less and less of a scarce resource, you are less and less valuable. That's how resources go, supply and demand. So we'll talk more about that if it comes up. If you want coaching, you can call in. Let me go back to delayed gratification made fun. So how do we increase our self-control, increase our mastery of ourself, and if we want to, how do we ensure our children, our employees, our clients develop those traits too? And the answer to that is in a second experiment that Walter Mischel did. And he did it just 1 year after the original marshmallow study. So the famous one is the second marshmallow study. But he did another study about a year later with self-efficacy expert Albert Bandura. Some people know Bandura from the Bandura curve, the learning curve. And he devised an experiment to see whether self-control was a fixed trait. In other words, you're either born with it or not, or something which could be learned. And so what they did in this experiment is they took kids this time in the fourth and the fifth grade, and they took kids who were grabbers. So remember, the delayers were the kids who waited for the second marshmallow. The grabbers were the kids who just ate the first marshmallow straight away. So they took fourth and fifth grade grabbers, and they put them in a room with an adult who was there as a role model. So the adult actually had the ability to delay gratification. And here's the results. I'm actually just going to read this bit out. This was how the results were written up in a book called Influencer by Kerry Patterson. After a single exposure to an adult model, children who previously hadn't delayed suddenly became stars at delaying. Even more interesting, in follow-up studies conducted months later, the children who had learned to delay retained much of what they'd learned during the brief modeling session. When Michelle took a closer look at individuals who routinely held out for the greater reward, he concluded that delayers are simply more skilled at avoiding short-term temptations. They didn't just avoid the temptation. They employed specific, learnable techniques that kept their attention off what would be merely short-term gratification and on their long-term goal, in this case, earning that second marshmallow. In other words, self-control and willpower aren't things you have or don't have. They're skills. They can be learned and can be developed. And if you want to teach them to others, well, develop them in yourself, and you become a role model for that. So here's an exercise you can do. Take a piece of paper, or you can do this on your computer, number it from 1 to 100, and over the next week, deliberately choose to do things or not do things, and then do them or don't do them, and jot them down when you do. So, for example, I did this when I was writing about it, and I wrote weekly newsletter, and that just meant I said I was going to write the newsletter, and I did. Took vitamin, meaning I said I was going to have a vitamin, and I did. No dairy, meaning that day I said I was going to not have dairy, and I did not have dairy. So my experience is that as you do this, as you make these simple little commitments and follow through on them, it gets easier and easier and easier to make bigger and bigger ones. So here's some keys if you wanted to play with this, is start small, monitor your progress. In other words, don't try to do this in your head, and notice where you failed. And if you failed, just put it right. In other words, either do what it is that you said you would do, or clean it up. Decide you're not going to do it. If it was somebody else was involved, just explain to them, look, I was going to do this. I'm not going to do this anymore. And just think about it. If you knew that the payoff for not grabbing the marshmallow now was, everything you ever dreamed of, would you find a way? Could you find a way to delay? And my guess is the answer to that will be yes. Let me go back to the phones. Let's go to Debbie in L.A. Debbie, welcome to the show. What can I do for you today?
Hi. I want to bring up a relationship, a personal relationship, not a career relationship, about I want my happiness now, and I'm in a new relationship, and I seem to be rushing things. I know what I want, and
so what do you want? You said you want your happiness now, but what does that mean?
Well, to me, a relationship looks like a partnership, in the same household, working for the same goals. Even though having separate careers and separate goals, you're working on the same team.
Okay,
that's what it looks like to me, and that's all that I'm used to. I was with one man since I was 19 for 30 years, and then he passed away. And then I was in another relationship for 3.5 years. And both of those relationships, we immediately started living together.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know that those two relationships were happily ever after. They were both pretty stormy.
Okay. So given that the relationships you've had have not been relationships that you would look, oh, God, I want to do that again.
Right.
How do you know, and I'm not saying you don't, but how do you know what a relationship that's wonderful looks like? Because you sound like you've got a very clear picture in your head.
Well,
but I'm wondering what you're basing it on.
I'm basing it on my parents.
Oh, okay.
I was just at a wedding, and they had the married couples come up on the dance floor, and they say, okay, everyone who's been together a year or less, leave. Everyone who's been together 5 years or less, leave. And they went all the way to 57 years, and only my parents were left.
Okay, so now, Debbie, I'd love to stay with us. Can you hang out with us over the break?
Sure.
Okay, we're coming up at a break. We're going to be back with Debbie. We're going to be back with some thoughts on how you create sustainable relationships. We're going to be back with more thoughts on delaying gratification made fun. And we're going to be back with you in just a few minutes. Bye-bye for now.
Real strategies for real change. This is Supercoach with Michael Neal.
We are back and we're talking with Debbie about relationships. And Debbie, now the story you were telling before the break is that there was a wedding and everyone was sort of being sent out of the room according to how long they'd been together. And at the end, the last ones in the room were your parents?
Well, off the dance floor.
Off the dance floor.
Yeah. My parents have been married for 57 years.
Now, here's the thing. Here's my question. Because you started, you told me that you were at one point with somebody for 30 years.
Yes, I was.
And that wasn't a relationship that you would hold up as a model of how you want things to be.
No, he was a drug addict and died of an overdose.
Okay. So is the fact that your parents were together, are together, have been together for 57 years, that sounds like longevity is the measure. And yet you've got an example in your own life of what most people would consider to be a very long time together with someone that isn't the measure.
Right, exactly.
So here's, I guess, where I'm going with it. And I may be reading into what you first said. So if I am, you just let me know that. But you equated wanting your happiness now with wanting to create the relationship a certain way. And what I know from the work I've done in relationships and the relationship I've been in for most of my adult life is happiness is something that you bring to a relationship. If it's something you're trying to get from the relationship, you're kind of in trouble from the start. Mm-hmm. So,
well, you know, I'm a pretty happy person. I really am. I just miss having someone by my side in the world.
Okay.
Because I'm used to that. I'm not used to dating. Dating is new. I got with my husband when I was 19.
Okay, I'm gonna say something that might sound a bit funny, and it's not really meant to. But get a puppy.
I have dogs.
Okay, because the thing is, companionship is great, and it is wonderful. I am a huge fan of loving long-term relationships, and I'm aware that they're very different if you think that you need them or that the source of your well-being and good feelings is the other person.
Uh-huh.
Then if you come in knowing, hey, I'm fine and this would be fun. This is something I want to have in my life. This will nourish and this will add to my life. And it brings something else out of me that I want to bring out, that I want to bring forth. That happens in relationship. For me, what happens in a relationship is when you have two people in a relationship who are both bringing their well-being to the relationship. I don't mean their best selves. There's a guy who's going to actually be a guest on the show next month, Dr. Greg Baer, and he talks about that when most people start relationships, they try to put their best foot forward.
Right.
And the problem with that is that at some point your partner realizes that you have another foot, and it
right.
usually stinks. You know, the reality is, you know, people are people. And if you're not going to find somebody who doesn't have things that you don't like about them.
Right.
The question is, are you willing to build the relationship based on love and enjoyment, which just basically says, hey, I don't need you to be a certain way to be happy. And I don't need you to be a certain way. There are certain things that, okay, you know, I'm not going to be in a relationship with somebody who's abusive. I'm maybe not going to be in a relationship with somebody who's got an addiction after what I've been through. But, you know, I recognize there are going to be things about you that aren't my favorite things. And that's not why I'm here. I'm not here to be with somebody who's just like this and just like that. And I can tick the list. I'm here to be with you. So here's my question, Debbie. When you say you want to rush it, what is it that you think you're trying to rush?
I guess I want to rush. We're already comfortable with each other. We're already living together. We're there. That we trust each other.
Oh, okay. So you're with somebody, you're living together, you trust each other.
Mm-hmm.
So what is it that you want to rush?
Living together.
But you already are.
No, I'm not living with him.
Oh, you're not? Oh,
no.
Okay.
No.
Okay.
No. He said no.
Okay.
Which is probably a very good thing.
Okay, so I sometimes listen, and it can work for me, and it can work against me. I sort of sometimes listen, assuming that there's a problem, and I'm listening here and going, I'm not hearing a problem.
Oh, I guess the problem is my discomfort in allowing him, in making that okay.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, to not rush it, to, you know, give him his space, because I certainly don't want somebody to live with me who doesn't want to. It's just that's what I'm used to. So I'm, you know, when he goes home at night to his house, mm-hmm. I'm left in an empty house, and I feel sad that I don't have someone with
me. Have you talked to your dog about it?
To my doggie?
Yeah. Because I'm not sure that your dog's going to be terribly happy that you're saying that you're left on your own.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
All I'm saying to you, what it sounds like to me, is you're in a wonderful place, and that what you think at some level, I need it to look like this.
Right.
It doesn't have to look like that. And at some point it might, but you're in a perfect marshmallow situation. You've got a marshmallow.
Yeah.
And you don't even have to wait to enjoy the marshmallow. To get a second marshmallow later. You get to enjoy this marshmallow. And if you're willing to actually enjoy this marshmallow now, the marshmallow you've got, then there's a very good chance that there's going to be a lot more marshmallows to come.
Yeah.
But if you try and... See, I don't think this is about marshmallows, actually. I think this is about geese and golden eggs.
And what do you mean by that?
Well... You know the story of the goose and the golden egg. You know, farmer has a goose lays golden eggs, farmer gets greedy, farmer slits goose's throat and rips open a goose's stomach to get all the golden eggs at once and discovers that, in fact,
it doesn't work that way.
Oh,
God, that is so perfect.
And it seems to me like you've got this lovely goose thing and there's golden eggs showing up most days. And... You're going, no, I want all the golden eggs now.
Exactly. I am.
Yeah, well, so don't. I mean, I know. I'm supposed to be the high pay. I should have something cleverer than that to say. But really, just stop it.
Yeah. Okay.
All right.
Yeah. I guess it's because I want it now, why I'm demanding it now, everything right now, is that I have had a lot of people die around me. Peers, my husband, his best friend. I have a girlfriend in hospice right now. I have a lot of peers dying. So it's like, you know, I don't want to wait. But
so
I guess I don't have to wait.
I was going to say, Debbie, last time I checked, your mailing address didn't affect how quickly you died.
Yeah.
It's two different things.
But that delayed gratification, you know, putting things off for later. Sometimes there isn't a later.
Well, sure, there isn't. And what you got to look at, though, is the purpose of a relationship to have a warm body in the room? In other words, is that really the gratification that you're after?
No.
And yeah, I wouldn't have thought so, because you had one of those. You've had a couple of those.
Yeah.
The gratification is in the love, is in the caring, and is in the fun.
Yeah, the fun. Let's put that at
and absolutely, I there is no need to delay that gratification.
Okay.
You got it?
Yeah.
Fantastic.
Great advice. Thank you.
Thank you, Debbie.
Bye.
Bye. And you know, look, this is something I kind of learned from my I really got this actually with my third child when Maisie was born. She She kind of. I remember I learned a lot the first 72 hours she was alive, and one of the things I learned is when you're hungry, eat, and when you're tired, sleep. So, you know, I'm talking about delaying gratification, and it's definitely, you know, a hallmark of maturity. It's been shown to be a, you know, secret of success, but it also can become an excuse to just get completely out of sync with your own natural rhythm. So, you know, people drive their bodies into a frenzy of fat-storing self-preservation by going on these diets that say, you've got to eat this time, and you've got to eat this time, and don't pay attention to when you're hungry or not. That's just your body trying to trick you. And what happens is because people so force, they do this delayed gratification in an area where actually there is a natural rhythm to things. And there's a natural rhythm to life. So when we're talking about delaying gratification, we're not talking about putting off the joy, putting off the love, putting off the happiness. We're talking about putting off buying the washing machine. We're talking about maybe waiting to get the really nice car until you've got a job. We're talking about that kind of a thing. We're not actually talking about the feelings, that you've got to put off the good feelings. People are way too good at that. We're talking about putting off some of the stuff until you're in a position where you can have all that stuff and more. So, you know, same thing with sleep. You know, people, there's research into ultradian rhythms, circadian rhythms, and it shows that you know, every 90 minutes, your body goes through a cycle where it there's an energy dip. And if you actually give in to that energy dip, and instead of having a shot of espresso or a cup of tea or a candy bar in that dip, once or twice a day, you actually just rest. You wind up being completely recharged for the day. Just slightly off topic, but you know, while I'm on the topic of things I learned from Maisie, emptying your tummy is as important as filling it. I'm not quite sure that I got on the air today intending to talk about this, but look, every person I've ever spoken with over the age of 70, and I've spoken with my fair share, agrees with my little daughter. I remember reading ads, Louis Armstrong, the jazz trumpeter, he would never advertise anything. And then he spent the latter part of his life as a spokesman. The thing he decided that he was gonna make his exception to the advertising rule was Metamucil, which kept him regular and happy. And as any baby will tell you, happiness is in fact a full tummy and an empty nappy. There's one other thing, and this relates to delayed gratification, and it relates to Maisie. And just, I don't know, I'm in that mood. If your needs aren't being met, share that with someone who can do something about it. So, you know, at some point, you know, we learn that it's not polite to get our needs met. Now, Maisie, when she was a baby, and in fact, all babies, they're experts at getting other people to help them meet their needs. They're never embarrassed about being helpless. They're not ashamed of it. They recognize that, you know, they need other people's resources, that that's going to be a kind of a key piece to them staying alive and thrive. And while we're on the subject, while we're talking about relationships, okay, I'm on a Maisie roll. Today's show, I'll rename it. It's having a daughter named Maisie made fun. But when you're feeling a bit out of sorts, there is no substitute for a good cuddle. I remember I worked many years ago, one of the first trainings I ever did, had a man on the training named Brian Edwards. And he went on to make a documentary that was phenomenal. And if you get a chance to see it, it's very hard to watch and it is brilliant. And it's called The Dying Rooms. And it's about these rooms that were, and from what I last talked to Brian a few years ago, so I don't know, but they were certainly on their way out. Rooms in Chinese orphanages where unwanted infants were just left alone to deny, to die. And they weren't even given a loving touch of a nurse or a caregiver. And in fact, in orphanages, there was a lot of research in the States that showed that they had a problem in Britain and then again in America where babies were dying in the 50s in these orphanages, in these post-war orphanages, and they couldn't figure out why, but the mortality rate for children in orphanages between 0 and 1 was huge. And what they finally figured out is the babies that were being held didn't die. And, you know, someday maybe there will be research that will prove what we kind of already know, that, you know, there's a real healing power to a really good hug. You know, so I guess all I'd say about that is, you know, just for today, be nice to yourself. You know, get in touch with the baby within. Eat when you're hungry. You know, sleep when you're tired. And just, you know, if your needs aren't being met, you can let people know about it. And when all else fails, you can go get a cuddle from someone who loves you. Thus endeth that particular lecture. Let me talk a little bit more about delayed gratification, put some context around it. Years ago, not many years ago, actually, in the last 10 years, Martin Seligman, who is a former president of the APA, the American Psychological Association, and a longtime researcher into things like depression and learned helplessness and learned optimism, he turned his work on its head and he became a pioneer in the field of positive psychology. And over the past few years, he and the researchers that were working with him developed 24 signature strengths, which were core traits that they realized were valuable in their own right, but became incredibly key when people put them into service of their highest values and purpose. And delayed gratification, the ability to delay gratification, was one of them, but I thought it might be interesting to just go through these. So as I go through this list, just make a note of what are the one or two or three that you kind of go, ooh, that's me. That really is a strength for me. So the first one is just curiosity and interest in the world. So are you somebody for whom it is just natural to bring a curiosity, and you're just fascinated by stuff? You're fascinated by ideas. You're fascinated by people. You people watch. You're fascinated by what's going on. That's actually one of your gifts. That's one of the things you were born to do. In fact, Seligman actually says in the book Authentic Happiness, here's the formulation for a good life. Use your signature strengths every day in the main realms of your life to bring abundant gratification and authentic happiness to life. So is curiosity, interest in the world one of yours? What about love of learning? Do you just love to learn? That's a strength. That is a gift. Not everybody has that strength as developed as maybe you do. Is your critical thinking, open-mindedness, your ability to make accurate assessments, is that a signature strength? What about street smarts? You one of those people who, you know, you may or may not also be book smart, but you got street smarts. How about social intelligence and emotional intelligence? Are you somebody who really can read a person and read a situation and knows when to move forward, when to pull back? How about perspective? Do you have the gift of perspective? Are you able to see things from multiple perspectives? One of my favorite quotes comes from, I believe, John Grinder, one of the co-founders, co-developers of neuro-linguistic programming. And he said, wisdom comes from experience, but experience alone is not enough. Experience anticipated and experience revisited is the source of wisdom. And that's perspective. When you have multiple perspectives, when you're able to see things from multiple points of view, you've got a much clearer picture of what's really going on. It's like the blind man and the elephant, right? The first blind man thought that was feeling the elephant's leg and thought, well, an elephant's a lot like a tree. And then another one was feeling the elephant's tail. Well, an elephant's a lot like a snake. Feeling the elephant's ears. Well, an elephant's a lot like a bat. Well, an elephant's a lot like an elephant. And when you've got the gift of perspective, when that's one of your strengths, then you really can put that to service and to put that to use. How about valor? Bravery, is that just one of those things that you've just got? You're one of those people who really can feel the fear and do it anyway, or even be fearless? That's a strength. Now, you can develop any of these. You don't either have them or not. They are skills to be developed, but most people have one or two or three of them that are significantly more developed. And those are incredibly useful places for you to come from. How about perseverance? Industry, diligence. Are you somebody who can really take something and stick with it and see it to the end? What about integrity, genuineness, and honesty? For you, are you somebody who can and really bring a sense of integrity to every situation, that you value honesty to the point where you're willing to really work with that? And these go on. You can actually find these if you go to the book Authentic Happiness, or if you go online to authentichappiness.org and look up signature strengths. You can find these. And of course, self-control, the ability to delay gratification, is one of them. It's one of those signature strengths that you can play with. And it's an experiment. It's actually, you can actually do a little online test, and it's all kind of fun. So that's something you can play with at how you put these things to use. Let's go back to the phones. Let's go to Ken in New York. Ken, welcome to the show. What can I do for you today?
Hi, Michael. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I wanted to ask you a question about genius. You're working, doing stuff in your genius, your zone of genius. And, you know, I've been pretty sure my whole life what my zone of genius was.
Right.
And I just feel like as I'm getting older and I want to have a family and I want to start making more money, I mean, I have money, but I don't make that much money. It sort of comes to me. But anyway, so basically, I don't know. Maybe I haven't found my genius. Maybe this isn't my genius.
Well, okay, let's explore it a little bit. What would you say your zone of genius is?
Music. Singing, maybe even more specifically.
Okay, and what is it about how you sing that you notice that people comment on? That, you know, what is it about your singing?
Specifically, I would say there's a sweetness to the way I can sing. I'm actually known for playing in hospitals all around New York, and I've been doing this for 10 years, and I started a nonprofit organization that we just had our 10-year anniversary, and whenever I play in the hospitals, if I had a dollar for every time they said, you're so much better than the American Idol people, but when I look deeper into the genius...
Yeah, did you ever ask which American Idol people specifically?
No. I mean, it's just more like, you know, I've made money singing and doing different things, but, you know, I find that if I was doing exactly what I wanted to be doing, which is basically singing my own songs, which mm-hmm. I've done, and I've been all over the country touring and doing all that thing, I guess what I'm saying is, it still seems like the path to the financial gain in it seems to be getting smaller and smaller these days. And I've been able to make it work as a professional musician even. But really, it doesn't, you know, I don't think I'm answering your question, actually, which is what specifically about my singing is genius.
I knew one of us would get there. Go for it.
Specifically, I just sound really good. I always have since I'm 5. I can imitate anything I want. And I've developed into having my own voice, and also I just love doing it. And there's so much connection that I have with people when I do it, when I play shows, when I sing in hospitals.
Okay, so here's one thing that I'm going to suggest is very often when people are looking at their genius, they get caught up in the form of it.
Mm-hmm.
And so it sounds like the form that you most often use your genius in is singing. But there's something in there about being able to connect with people through your voice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure.
Now, if you broadened your definition of your genius from singing mm-hmm. to connecting with people, having an impact on people with my voice,
mm-hmm.
what else does that open up for you? And I'm not asking you to commit to doing anything. I just mean it's a pure exploration.
I would say really anything having to do with dealing with people.
Mm-hmm.
I look at all the things, you know, what I've done and all the things I could do. I mean, I think I'd make an excellent almost anything except for a research scientist.
Right. Yeah. You don't accidentally create nonprofits that are still going 10 years later.
No.
And so I'm going to say, and I'm only doing this because we're coming towards the end, but
yeah.
here's what I would say mm-hmm. is if you're willing to relook at, okay, what is the essence of my genius, of my gift?
Mm-hmm.
What you'll find is that it's a lot bigger than singing.
Mm-hmm.
And if you then go, okay, how can I apply this genius to the project of making money? You'll find all sorts of ways. I remember we had a guy on a course. I'll do the story really quick.
Mm-hmm.
We had a guy on a course, and he said that his genius was making his mother-in-law feel comfortable in their home.
Hmm.
And everyone laughed. But when we looked at what the essence of that was, it was about making people feel welcome anywhere.
Hmm.
And suddenly, when he got that was his genius, he found all sorts of ways. And in fact, they wound up opening a B&B, a bed and breakfast.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not saying that's what you do,
mm-hmm.
but I'm saying that when you widen the definition, you'll find all sorts of things that haven't occurred to you yet.
Right. Okay.
Thanks, Ken. You can always
check
in on the forums at geniuscatalyst.com. Thanks to all of you for joining me for lunch or tea or dinner, whatever time it was. I hope you'll come back next week. Bring a friend, and we will be back with a brand new show. Same time, same channel. Have fun, learn heaps, and I'll talk to you then. Bye-bye for now.